This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Our diverse communities have one home, Joy.
You're on Saturday Magazine with Fiona and Misha Ketchell, the editor of The Conversation. Thanks again for coming in, Misha.
It's a pleasure. There's air conditioning in here, so that's good.
There is. Believe it or not, I actually turned the air conditioning a little bit up because it was a little bit chilly.
Really?
Oh, that's good. I know. Yep. It's perfect temperature now, I think. So while we're actually waiting for our next guest, who is on his way in, which is Josh Burns, the member for McNamara, we should touch on Sam Kerr because we know that people want to hear about that. It's such an interesting case.
It's what everybody's talking about.
It really is. I must have read about five different interpretations and articles about it just in the last 2 days.
And it's one of those things which is at once sort of serious in a way. I mean, there's some serious issues that it raises. And also, it is a little bit funny. And the fact that, you know, she's been charged with this thing from an incident, a drunken incident in a cab a year ago, you know, it does seem, I think, to many people a little bit ridiculous and disproportionate to what actually happened.
And but I think what's really interesting that we wouldn't know here in Australia is that they have very, very strict laws in the UK, and you could go to jail for saying something like that if they prove that it was racially motivated. And then there's the whole issue of motivation.
Yeah, so she's actually been charged with racially harassing a police officer. And as I understand it, there was an interesting piece in Crikey this week by a lawyer, Michael Bradley, who was talking about the elements of the offence. And basically, you have to say something which is racially motivated or racially inflected with the intent of singling out somebody on the basis of their race and, you know, sort of creating a negative consequence for them or harassing them. Now, I guess the first thing is what happened, as we understand it, was there was an incident in a cab. You know, Sam Kerr had vomited in the cab and then a police officer was there and she was in some dispute about the fare and she allegedly called the UK police officer a stupid white bastard. Now, there's a reference to his race or his racial group there in a way, although there's a debate about whether white is a race or not, which is another question. But I don't know how you can see that as constituting racial harassment because the actual comment to actually establish the offence has to be motivated by the race. Mm. And the comment was motivated by anger at him in the context of a dispute about something else. It's actually an interesting famous Australian case from about 20 years ago with a woman called Samantha Power who was visiting her partner in a South Australian prison and she was refused entry. And she called one of the prison officers a white piece of shit. And that one went to court as well. And it was found that she hadn't racially vilified the prison officer in Australia because the primary motivation of it wasn't singling that person out on the basis of their race. She referred to the person's race in the context of expressing justifiable anger. She was angry that she couldn't see her partner in prison. But it wasn't motivated by the person's race. And therefore, in that ruling in the Australian court, which doesn't have any influence in the UK, but in that instance, she was found not to have, racially vilified the prison officer. I think really in this thing, the same should really stand, which is that the primary motivation of the comment, although there was a reference to, you know, the racial grouping of the UK policemen, the primary motivation of the comment wasn't racial. I think Sam Kerr's lawyers will try to have it thrown out. And I think they'll have a pretty strong case.
I think you might be right there. Absolutely. It's really raised so many interesting topics. And I think that, you know, while there was a racial element, as you say, was it racism? I can't see how they're going to be able to make that case.
Yeah, but we'll see. I mean, it's going to take a while, apparently. So,
But then there's that question from Craig Foster about the fact that she should be stood down from her captaincy while this is in play. I mean, we still don't know much about whether anything will occur in that case.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I heard an interview this week with a former Australian soccer player and lawyer who was talking about the fact that many of the rules that regulate behaviour of athletes in sporting codes were really made when men's codes were dominant and that there aren't necessarily rules for elite female athletes, and maybe we need to think about how that actually occurs. And I mean, there's a bit of a grey area around this whole thing in sport in terms of standing people down over allegations. Now, you know, the lens through which I look at that stuff is really employment law, which is to what extent is there a nexus with your employment? And yes, if you're in the public eye, there is some nexus. But in a circumstance where something has not been proven, you know, you sort of want to give the benefit of the doubt to the person, you know, against whom the allegation has been made until something's proven. I think that just seems like just basic procedural fairness.
Misha, there's also a text that's just come through there just for you to look at on the screen, which just talks about why was there a year's delay before the charge was actually made?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a very good question. I don't know the answer apart from to say that the British system runs very slowly. There might have been some question about what actually the charge was going to be. But it does seem, it seems very strange on so many levels. I mean, given the magnitude of the incident, it just doesn't really make sense.
Thanks, Victor, for sending in that message. Now, speaking of bringing in our next guest, Josh Burns, welcome to the studio.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. You've got this very vibrant Fun Run t-shirt on. Yeah. I'm like, who would be running in this weather, really?
I know this is not a visual medium, but I was at gym just before coming on here, just down the road, and it would not have been a pretty sight for anyone in the studio had I not quickly had a shower and put on a t-shirt. And I'm wearing the Carmen's Fun Run t-shirt, which is a very bright pink shirt that our team did the Fun Run a couple of weeks ago, which was a fun run to raise money for the Breast Cancer Network Australia.
Well, it's pretty bright, Josh, and we are very happy to have your sunny, bright demeanour in the studio. Of course, you will have met my wonderful co-host, Misha Ketchell, who is filling
Morning,
in
Misha.
Today.
Morning, Misha. Morning. Macca always listens when he's not here, keeping an eye on things. But we're going to have a great time without him, and you know, he'll never know.
Well, he will certainly be tuning in. I believe that he might even be in Taiwan. That's where we think he is. So welcome, Macca, if you are able to tune in. Yeah. We miss you, we love you, but we're running the show without you.
Yeah, yeah. There's a new sheriff in town, Macca. And his name's Misha.
So, Josh, now I know that there's been some interesting announcements this week in line with International Women's Day.
Yeah.
Would you like to tell us more about what's been going on?
Absolutely. Well, the biggest announcement that the Minister for Women, Katie Gallagher, made this week was around ensuring that the government will pay superannuation for people on paid parental leave. So this comes on top of our reforms to paid parental leave, which I've spoken about previously on this program, where we have made paid parental leave far more flexible. So whether you're a single parent, whether you're in a family of two males, two females, whatever the makeup of your family, you have flexibility to choose who's going to take time off. It's also encouraging to have a shared paid parental arrangement so that if you are the primary caregiver, that there is and often that is a woman, that you are encouraged to share that caregiving with someone else. The next stage of that, which is something that I think is a really important reform, is to pay superannuation on top of that paid parental leave, because we know that especially women are retiring with less superannuation than men, and there is a gender pay gap, which we are trying to get rid of, and it's now the lowest it's ever been in Australian history, but we need to continue to get that down to zero, and so this is another policy to try and make it more fair, make it more equitable, and I think it's a really important reform.
Yeah, I mean, it's an absolute no-brainer. I mean, the idea that, you know, women should be penalised because they're at home looking after the children, raising the next generation of taxpayers to pay for people's, you know, retirements and so on. But I think that I was interested that Senator James Patterson referred to it as welfare.
Well, I mean, the Liberal Party have gone through a sort of a round of pre-selections, let's say that, and they've had a number of high-profile seats, including replacing Scott Morrison in the seat of Cook, which is as safe a Liberal seat as there probably exists, and yet again they have not only failed to pre-select more women to bring in their party towards parity, but even the women that they do have, there are there were reports today about major challenges to their pre-selection, including front benches. So the Liberal Party clearly have a problem with women, and they have a problem with pre-selecting women and of embracing women in their organisation. And it's something that if the Liberal Party continues to ignore, they'll continue to be punished, I think. And the Labor Party only got to the point in which we are now, where we have parity in the caucus, in the Federal Parliamentary Labor Party, between representative between men and women, because we set quotas. Mm. It was only, you know, we had to ensure that women were not being overlooked by the structural issues that they that had led them to be overlooked for generations. So we made the changes internally, and I think our party is stronger for that. You know, we look at some of the people in female in leadership in our party, people like Penny Wong, Katie Gallagher, Tanya Plibersek, Amanda Rishworth. You know, we have incredible women who are smart and strong leaders who I admire very much, and our country and our party is better for it.
I saw something on social media this week with...
That's dangerous. As a start. Yeah.
Well, that's why I'm asking you, because yeah. It was, I think, claiming... I think it was actually from Anthony Albanese's account, claiming that 54% of the government is women. I just was wondering what that was based on. Is that like members of parliament, or is that cabinet, or like what's that figure from? Do
you know? Unless I'm much mistaken, Misha, it's members of the party, so the Federal Parliamentary Party. Okay. And cabinet is also 50% women as well. I don't know if it's 54. I think it's 52 or something. I think it's slightly small. I'd have to double check the figures, but I'm pretty sure that our party as a whole is 54% women in terms of House and Senate representation.
Okay, interesting. So just going back to the super for a minute. So yep. This is the government super scheme. So this is like sort of the residual scheme in a way if your employer doesn't pay it. I think, I forget how many weeks it is. Is it 13 or something? Is that right?
It's been increased to 26.
26, that's right.
Yeah, okay. It will be increased to 26 over time. Yep.
So it's the super paid on the top of that. So it's your 11% super guarantee or whatever it is currently.
We'll pay 12.
12, yeah, 12. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So it's look, I think the important part of this discussion is, you know, yes, this is a really important policy. And as Fiona really articulately said before, we don't want people to be punished for taking time to, you know, to be the primary caregiver to a child. But more than that, there is a broader picture here that we actually need to be addressing. And this forms part of that picture. And that is to say we have a pay disparity in our country, that there aren't enough women in senior leadership positions, and that women who are predominantly the primary caregivers are being punished for taking time off. And therefore, this is another suite of policies, including the ones we're taking to try and reduce the gender pay gap, to try and make things more equitable in our economy. On top of also trying to increase the wages of some of those highly feminized industries, aged care being the most obvious one, where we supported the case for a 15% pay increase at the Fair Work Commission. Obviously, there are other industries that we need to continue to push up for. But you know, we have a long way to go, but I think there has been real progress made in trying to make our economy a bit more equitable.
Well, I found the gender pay gap in a recent release of information just absolutely appalling. Mm. I think that the fact that companies are made, I don't want to say shamed, but they were named, and that we now have that information is really a good thing. Mm. I know that it's a little bit, there's probably other consequences which we're yet to see from that, but I was absolutely appalled by it.
I know that, sorry, good morning, Josh. I just pulled
good morning.
I know that Misha's probably a bit of a data nerd like me, but one of the things I was going to ask is the data that was published didn't give us a full like-for-like comparison on job roles. It was almost a total salary bill.
Yeah.
And if you've got a larger proportion of women in lower paid roles, then that will give you a disparity. Is there any data that's going to be published about the real like-for-like comparison on same role stuff? Because I think that's where the real issue needs to be targeted as well.
Well, I would actually push back on that slightly, Paul, and say that I do think that at the heart of this is also around the types of roles that women are having in companies, because that is important. Because if women are not in senior leadership roles, then that is going to show up on the pay disparity. Mm-hmm. But also it's a reflection of what sort of structural issues is inside that organization. I've spoken to a number of the big corporate companies who have been who've published their data, and it is leading to their change. I mean, they see that many corporates try and see themselves as good corporate citizens, and they want to be leaders in this. They want to have equity between their male and female employees. It's really important for their internal culture. So I actually think that if this data is showing, and I'll answer your other question in a second, if this data is showing that there is a disparity between the sorts of roles that men and women are employed in inside a company, well, then that's a huge deal. And I think a really important outcome, in fact, possibly the most important outcome. Companies are getting better at having, you know, men and women employed to do the same job and being paid the same. Where I still think there is disparity there, but where I think there is even more work to be done is, you know, how are we creating the structures where women are going into senior leadership positions in companies? And I think that's part of this. In terms of the data as well, more broadly, I'm not sure what else Katie's planning on releasing, but I do think that, and I can come back to you on that, but I do think that having this spotlight on the pay of our major employees, anyone who's employing over 100 people, is a really powerful tool. And there is a public accountability because next year the data's coming out again and we'll be able to see and track which companies are improving and which ones are not.
Hmm. I do think there's a need for both. I mean, yeah. I think, you know, you've got to get more women in leadership positions.
Yeah.
More women in politics. I think I said earlier this morning is, you know, I think the world might be a safer place if there was a few more female leaders in our political parties.
It's actually interesting because there's an organisation, that's lobbying for more women on boards, for example, and getting more women into leadership. Leadership positions is important. But I think there's another thing as well, which functions separately, which is there are certain industries which are traditionally lower paid because they've traditionally been in areas of work that are conducted predominantly by women. And, you know, you look at things like childcare, teaching, you know, parts of book publishing, and there's all sorts of areas. And I don't think they would show up in these figures that were released last week or the week before. Because what they're looking at is the actual parity within a company.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at an industry, if you look at individual industries, you might say, well, there's parity within that industry. But because that industry has a high number of women, traditionally some of those industries are paid less. So I think, you know, it's one of those problems that you do want to deal with from the top end, you know, in the distribution of the senior roles, absolutely. But also I do think you need that industry lens as well, probably.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We will be... hold those thoughts, and we will be back actually just after a short break.
That was a throw to me. Sorry, Jen. I was napping then. I just wanted to ask Joss a question about the news that came out late the week before this week about Meta withdrawing from the News Media Bargaining Code.
Yep.
Now, for anybody that doesn't know about this code, it was designed by Rod Sims, the former chair of the ACCC. The idea was that the digital platforms, particularly Google and Facebook, would have to pay media companies for the use of journalism. And it was based around the idea that there was a market failure in that the journalism companies were producing a lot of very expensive journalism and the digital platforms were profiting from it without paying from it. Mm. Meta has been negotiating around this all over the world because the legislation we had in Australia was sort of world leading, and others have sort of copied it, and there's been a big dispute in Canada now where Meta's not putting news on Canadian websites, and they've announced that they're not going to be featuring news in Australia so as to avoid a paying Australian media outlets. So my question really, Josh, for you is, this is a matter for the government to make a decision about whether to designate Meta under the laws and respond. What's the thinking so far?
Well, this is a great question. And in fact, Misha, you'll remember as part of the lead up to a lot of this, Meta or Facebook actually pulled a lot of government sites off their platform. And there was this whole, you know, there was this whole anger about the community not being able to access things like emergency services pages and a whole range of other pages. And your description at the start was 100% right in that if you look at the ABC on Facebook, or if you look at, you know, if you look at the ABC Twitter account because you're on Twitter or whatever Elon Musk has, you know, broken it into, you're actually not on the ABC content page. You're on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. Mm-hmm. And so what this original deal was designed to do was to be able to say, well, if you're landing there, then they're actually selling advertising space. That as a user, if you're on one of their platforms on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or whatever it is, then they're able to use your time on that platform to sell advertising. And that advertising traditionally would have gone directly to funding journalists, directly to funding media outlets, good independent media. I mean, they sort of talk about the golden age of newspapers in Australia being the 90s. And to give you a sense of the scale of how much things have changed, in the 90s, the advertising revenue for The Age was something in the vicinity of the equivalent of around $4 billion a year. Huge. Now The Age's advertising revenue is somewhere hovering around the $200 million mark. So you're looking at a dramatic reduction in the amount of revenue that media companies are able to acquire. And that obviously means the reduction in journalists, the reduction in journalists covering unique stories, and it's a reduction in the strength of our independent media. So this whole thing was designed to make that a bit fairer and for Facebook to pay for the content that, frankly, they're using and using to sell on to advertisers. The fact that they've pulled out is the worst kind of corporate greed. I mean, it really is. It really is, just an awful bad faith display from a company that is very big and quite profitable and using Australian content in order to produce profit for their own company and not willing to contribute to the very content that is driving people to their own platforms.
Let me put you up for that just for a moment and play devil's advocate for
sure,
Meta.
Please.
Their argument would be, we've made a commercial decision not to feature news. News is not driving much of our engagement. It's less than 3%. We don't need it. It's costing us too much. It's too much trouble. We're a business. Why should we have to have news?
Well, if they pull news off their entire platform, then that's a matter for them. But I do think that they entered into this in a good faith agreement. And as we know, people do use their platforms. I mean, Facebook is no longer just, it's not just a small media outlet. This is a major platform where millions and millions of Australians, I think it's over 10 million Australians, have access to this. And especially in remote places, we know that these are key platforms for people to access important information. And so for Facebook, this is, if they are purely looking at this without looking at what are the broader societal impacts of their decision and what are the impacts on the independent news outlets, then I think they should be held to account. And if they're unwilling to be a part of that ecosystem, then they can be called out for it. I don't think it's an excuse, frankly. And if that's their business decision, then they can be judged accordingly.
Some people would argue, though, that a government coming in and forcing Facebook to pay is actually just punishing innovation and success in business. That at a time when the traditional media companies were perhaps complacent and didn't do a very good job of designing better advertising products, Facebook came up with a model which got a huge audience. They got massive amounts of data. They got much more effective advertising than anybody ever before. And the argument that again would be made is, why should you tax a company like Facebook for its commercial success? And why should, if you think public interest journalism is important, and that's something that you value as a public good, whether Facebook's in that game or not is surely their choice. Surely there are other ways that you should be supporting public interest journalism.
Well, it's not just Facebook. It's also all of the other platforms, which there are. They do broadcast media. So if all of them were to get out and this was to be a feature where no major platform was accessing our media, then I think that this conversation might be a little bit more straightforward. But it's not the reality at the moment. And I do think that Facebook, as a large company, has some level of corporate responsibility. So by entering into this agreement, they entered it in good faith. It hasn't broken the bank in Facebook. It's a very large company. And for the purposes of funding content that they were benefiting from, I think it was a fair and reasonable proposition. More broadly, I mean, I think the government does have a role to regulate our online space in a way that is in the interests of the Australian people. And, you can't just publish anything you want on Facebook without repercussion. And I do think that we're constantly playing catch up with how we regulate Facebook, but there are unknowns, and this is a new technology and this is a new frontier, and government is a slow organization that is constantly trying to catch up to how we best regulate it in the best interests of our society. So look, I'm not here to say Facebook must do X, Y, and Z. I'm saying Facebook came into an agreement. They use content made by Australian media outlets, and they paid for it, and they paid for it in good faith. They've now walked away and said, look, we're not going to be paying for media outlets, and that's going to have an effect on Australian journalism. And we think that's, for a company as big and as powerful as Facebook, is a poor decision.
Misha, a question for you, just a different angle. We've seen, particularly in the States, but also in other countries, the spread of disinformation and inaccurate reporting. If news was to come off Facebook, as an example, and all news came off, surely there's a way of people getting news. They go back to the traditional outlets and therefore a more trusted outlet. Do you think that could be beneficial to journalism in some way?
Possibly. I think one of the things that a lot of journalists were very skeptical about from the very beginning was whether we should be giving our product to something like Facebook, which doesn't actually play by the rules of journalism. So when I produce an article, I've got to make sure it's accurate. I've got to fact check it. I've got to comply with defamation laws. I have to have an understanding of my responsibility to my community, to the Australian community, when I produce that journalism. And I'll be held accountable under our laws. Now, somehow Facebook has managed to create this sort of culture where they're a publisher, but they're not a publisher. The rules that other ethical rules that other publishers function under, they don't function under. They basically will put out all sorts of things, including things that are harmful, things that are misinformation, things that divide society, things that create hate, things that threaten people's safety. They've done all sorts of very morally questionable things by basically not playing by the rules. So journalists have said, should we ever have been playing with Facebook in the first place? The interesting thing really is the story of the bait and switch. So I was at the ABC in sort of the around about 2010, and Mark Scott was the managing director at the time. And I remember, you know, we were embracing Facebook because we were like, we can put our content on Facebook. As a public broadcaster for Australia, we can reach massive audiences, and that's good for everybody. And Facebook said at that point it was committed to journalism. What's happened is it's done that, it's built this massive audience, and now it's said, oh, we don't need that anymore. It's sort of like a bait and switch. We're going to play with you. We're committed to journalism. And up until last week in Australia, they said they were committed to journalism, and now they've said no. And the consequences of that are that the audience is there, and that audience, without any journalism, is going to get a mix of misinformation and disinformation that could actually be quite damaging to Australia's body politic, to our media ecosystem. And that's where I think the really interesting questions arise.
Sorry, you caught me off guard there, Misha. I just wanted to remind our listeners, because this is such a great conversation, and I know that everyone will have some thoughts on this, since many people are social media users. If you do want to join our conversation, please text in 0427 569 949 or on air at joy.org.au. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
We've got about another 5 minutes left with Josh. So do you want to squeeze in another question while we've got him?
Yes. I mean, I was actually just going to say, Misha, you wrote a piece in The Conversation, an editorial today on this, and I found the comments fascinating.
Yeah, look, I think a lot of people are very angry at what something like Facebook is doing to our media ecosystem and to our society, because there is a really key thing about social cohesion that lies underneath this. I mean, I think I might have talked about this before, but the Scanlon Foundation has been collecting data on social cohesion in Australia for 16 years. This year's results were the worst on record. And you can see in everything about the way something like Facebook operates that actually what it does is it fuels division. I mean, there's a book by this guy, Ben Smith, who used to be the editor of BuzzFeed, and he talks about the ways in which they used to produce posts that were intentionally divisive because they knew it would fuel engagement, both positive and negative. And those algorithms are designed to prioritize engagement, but with no sense of what they're actually doing to the communities in which they're creating that engagement.
I don't believe any media outlet would be contrarian on purpose, Misha.
Well, I mean, that's...
Not even Macca would ever do that.
That's
You're
true.
On choice.
And look, I mean, I guess one of the arguments is the media's always been imperfect. The media is imperfect. Yeah. And look, you know, I've obviously got skin in this game. You know, we've done a deal under the News Media Bargaining Code with Google, The Conversation. We didn't do one with Facebook. Facebook shut us and SBS out. We were disappointed about that. And, you know, I think it's very...
Did it have an impact on your bottom line and the ability to fund journalism?
It did, and it will. I mean, we're talking about, with this Facebook money, I think it's estimated to be around about $70 million, something like that, a year.
Yeah.
And I think what it's going to mean is for some small regional and rural publishers and a lot of publishers, it might be between 15 and 30% of their revenue.
Yeah.
This is real news gathering jobs. And again, it's sort of replacing that journalistic function with something else, with another form of content that might have strong opinions. But, you know, in terms of people being informed and being able to have conversations where the references are really clear, it doesn't fulfill the same function.
We'll be talking more about this in the second hour with our special guest, Peter Grest, which will be really interesting. So
give Peter my regards.
We will, Josh. So in the final few minutes, Josh, before we hand over to news, are there any other topics that you would like to share with us that you think are most relevant? Do you want to talk about, for example, Super Tuesday?
Super Tuesday. Well, it seems like we're going to another Biden Trump election, which is which will be fascinating.
Do you think age is a problem? I mean, can you really elect an 81-year-old? I'm
an Australian citizen, so I don't have a vote in the American elections, and I genuinely believe that as a member of the Australian Parliament and by extension the Australian government, there is a responsibility of us not to be engaging too much in American domestic politics other than when it relates to Australia's national interest. I do think that one of the things we really need in Australia is a reliable partner, and I think that the Biden administration has been a responsible administration from that point of view. There obviously were and there have been concerns around the former president's comments around NATO and some of the ways in which he would seek not to engage in international fora, which would obviously affect Australia and how we engage with the region deeply. So we will continue to invest in our relationship with the United States because it is such an important relationship.
Let me put the question another way then.
Sure, sure.
Anthony Albanese has been very successful. He's 81.
He's not everyone, by the way.
I'm imagining a point in the future to a time. Are you going to be saying, yes, we should continue to have this person leading our political party and leading the country at that age?
Well, obviously, we're getting into a hypothetical situation.
We are in exactly a hypothetical.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things in America, the polling that's coming out, is that over 60% of Americans are unsatisfied with the fact that it's a President Trump-Biden, President Biden rematch, which probably goes to the state of American politics and the discontent that it does exist. And it will be interesting to see how that plays out of what choice the American people make. I think in Australia, rejuvenation and having people have a career but then moving on is a healthy thing. And it's the same way in which the Americans have designed the system so that a US president can only do two terms. You're not designed to be there forever. You're designed to be there to give it enough time to make change and then give the country another chance to elect someone new.
Where are the young people that are actually standing up in that country? I mean, that's what I want to know. Why isn't there any... That's a question for
For another day.
More
young people in pink shirts getting involved in politics.
That's so right. You're on Saturday Magazine. Thank you so much, Josh. And it's now time.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.